Okay. Hello, and welcome to Nothing But Space, a weekly podcast where we talk about everything related to our universe, including the Milky Way, black holes, and other observable and non-observable phenomena. I am your host, Francesca Fernandez, and I will be taking you through what I hope to be a transformative journey. So, if you'll remember, last week we went through like a very thorough overview of black holes, and then I gave you like a little tour of the black hole. So we talked about the singularity, we talked about the event horizon, we talked about what exists in some black holes that do not rotate and are electrically charged, known as the Cauchy horizon, and we also talked about the ergosphere. So today, to kind of expand on our knowledge of black holes, we're going to think a little bit broader and think about the different types of black holes, because yes, that's right. Even though black holes are already complex enough, now we have to talk about there's different types of black holes that we can kind of categorize them into. So we have primordial mass black holes, we have stellar mass black holes, we have intermediate mass black holes, we have supermassive black holes, and we have quasars. And four of these black holes, I'm not going to spoil which one is not, but four of them are confirmed by science, and one of them is not. So in order of like increasing size, we have primordial black holes, which are the smallest ones, then stellar mass, then intermediate mass, then supermassive, which is basically a quasar. So supermassive black holes and quasars are around the same size. And so, quick review, a black hole is essentially a region of space that is so dense and the gravity is so strong that light can't escape, and nothing can escape unless it's traveling faster than the speed of light, which, as we know, is the limit of our cosmos. So basically, once you pass a certain point in the black hole, known as the event horizon, you literally cannot leave. It's like a prison cell, okay? You're just trapped in there forever. And so I feel like what's interesting about black holes is that if you ask like the typical layperson or someone who doesn't know a lot about black holes, there's this like stereotype or image that black holes are these huge, scary bodies that like, I don't know, they're just ginormous. They're so big, you can't even comprehend them. And yes, for some black holes, like supermassive black holes, that is the case. But for the first type of black hole we're going to talk about, that's actually not true. And so the first one we're going to talk about, cue my introduction, is primordial black holes. And these are the smallest black holes that are known to exist. And they're honestly pretty hypothetical because we, as physicists, have never observed a black hole that small. And so what I mean by the size is that these black holes, these primordial black holes, they could be 100,000 times smaller than a paperclip, or they could be up to 100,000 times greater than the sun. And so, yeah, that's a very large range, right? You could have a black hole that's 100,000 times smaller than a paperclip, or 100,000 times greater than the sun. And all this depends on when this primordial black hole was formed. That is like dictating how large it is. And so with primordial black holes, as long as you have like a few micrograms of material that's packed so, so, so densely, then you could have a black hole that is very, very, very small. And so what's interesting about primordial black holes is that these could be the seed for supermassive black holes. And so what could have been originally a primordial black hole could now be a supermassive black hole. So if you think about it like a plant growing, right? The primordial black hole is like the seed. And as it's like flowering and growing and going through stages of life, it'll eventually grow into this supermassive black hole. And so the thing about primordial black holes is that in 1974, Stephen Hawking discovered that black holes evaporate over time. And so right now, the only primordial black holes that would still exist would have to be pretty large, because the small ones would have evaporated by now, since our universe is kind of old. Well, I guess it's not old. Right now, it's pretty young. But I'm just saying, like, relative to what we think of time, it seems pretty old. So these black holes, what they're doing is they're emitting radiation, okay? And as they're emitting particles, they shrink over time. And that should make sense, because if you think about it, the black holes, they're emitting radiation, they're emitting particles, and the black holes are literally composed directly of matter and of these particles. So if they're emitting particles and letting some of them go, then they should be shrinking over time. And that's what's happening. So eventually the black holes will evaporate. So now what we've kind of like settled on is that if a black hole is larger than the small asteroid when it first formed, then it could still be in the universe today. But if it was not larger than a small asteroid, then by now it probably would have evaporated and it would be long gone. So with primordial black holes, here's how we think they formed. And the theory is for the early universe after the Big Bang. Okay, and if you don't know, just TLDR to the Big Bang, like a short summary. Basically, this is the event that many physicists think basically created our universe as it is. And so this one event was like the birth of the universe as we know it today. And so here's the theory for how primordial black holes formed. What we think happened is that after the universe was first birthed, there was just like a giant soup of particles. And so we would have like quarks, we'd have gluons, which if you don't know, these particles just basically make up protons and neutrons. And we would have all these particles just kind of swimming around, just doing their own thing, okay? And so the idea here is that these particles would clump together randomly and they would form areas that are not the same in density. So you'd have one area of these clumped together particles that's denser than the other area. And because of these differences in density, right, you have these density fluctuations, because of this, this would eventually collapse into what we know as a primordial black hole. And these density fluctuations do not have to be super drastic. You don't need an area that's like 70 times more dense than another area. If you have an area that's even just like 10% denser than another area, it could have collapsed into a black hole. And so just to be even more specific, at its birth, the universe had tons of matter and energy, and it was all in the form of extremely hot plasma. So after the first 100,000th of a second, which is such a tiny like amount of time just to think about. So after the first 100,000th of a second, the universe would cool a little bit. And in cooling, you would have these loose particles in the plasma, which are quarks and gluons. So these quarks and gluons, they would bind together into heavier particles, and they would form protons and neutrons. And then when these loose particles would bind together, the pressure would drop. So the pressure of the hot plasma in the universe would drop. And because of this pressure drop, you'd have all these regions collapsing into black holes. Now, I think what's most interesting about primordial black holes is really the theories that come with it. It's not actually like the black hole or the idea of the primordial black hole itself. And what is really piquing the interest of a lot of physicists and a lot of astronomers is that primordial black holes sound a lot like dark matter. And so just to describe dark matter, I want to do a whole episode on it because it is so fascinating, but dark matter is essentially matter in our universe that doesn't interact with light. It only interacts with gravity, but it makes up 90% of the matter in our universe. And this matter is kind of like weird, it's kind of intriguing, it's like fascinating, it's mysterious because it doesn't interact with light, so we can't really see it. But we know it's there because it interacts gravitationally with other bodies. So what we're thinking about primordial black holes and dark matter is that perhaps primordial black holes in our early universe, if they merged together, maybe primordial black holes could be composed of dark matter. And so let me expand a little bit more on that. So if the primordial black holes merged in our early universe, we would expect to see a galactic halo populated by many of these large primordial black holes. These would be called MACHOs, or massive astrophysical compact halo objects. And what we're seeing is that the data is showing that in these galactic halos, there are many black holes. And so if we look in nearby galaxies or in the Andromeda galaxy, which is the nearest galaxy to the Milky Way, we do see many black holes. And because we're seeing that, that matches up with the data that's showing that if primordial black holes could possibly be made of dark matter, they would have to be populating the galactic halo. And they are. So could primordial black holes be made of dark matter? Maybe. Now, the other thing about this is that primordial black holes, so what would have to happen is that they would cluster in clumps throughout the universe. And then because they're in these little clumps, they would be able to merge. And by merging, you would eventually have these large black holes surrounded by smaller black holes. And that's also what we're seeing. So if we look at the black holes that have been observed in nearby galaxies or in Andromeda, we see a large black hole surrounded by a bunch of smaller ones. And that is also matching up with our data that perhaps primordial black holes could be made of dark matter. And so how do these primordial black holes merge then, right? Because I was talking like, well, for this to kind of match up with our idea that primordial black holes are made of dark matter, they have to have merged in the early universe. And so how do black holes merge? Well, black holes merge when you have two black holes that are sharing the same surrounding gas cloud. And so basically a black hole, as it is growing bigger and growing fatter and eating more matter, it's kind of sucking in the gas and the substance around it. And so if you have two black holes that are sharing the same gas cloud, eventually they both begin eating the same gas cloud. So they're eating this gas cloud. And eventually, as they're eating it up and really getting fatter and fatter, they eventually begin spiraling in and eating each other. And as they're eating each other up, they merge from two black holes that are separate into one big, chunky, huge black hole. And so the way we sense these black holes merging, and the way we just sense black holes in general, is through gravitational waves. And so let me describe a little bit more about gravitational waves, because that's probably a really confusing concept. And so just imagine if you take a blanket and you, or like a tarp, and you stretch it out as thin as you can stretch it, okay? It's super thin. And then imagine that you're placing like a basketball in the on the tarp, okay? Obviously the tarp is going to be pushed downwards by the force of the basketball. And if you move the basketball around, you'll see like the tarp kind of contorting around it. And so that's kind of how we view like ripples in the fabric of space-time, right? You're just kind of imagining like if you have two basketballs on this tarp that's stretched out thin, and then you kind of like push them together, the tarp is gonna like move around and stuff. And so those are kind of the gravitational waves that we can sense using certain detectors and technology. And so by looking at this gravitational wave and the properties, we can estimate the sizes and features of the objects that produce these gravitational waves. Or to be specific, we can estimate the size and features of the black holes that were producing these gravitational waves as they merged. And so some of the properties we could look at, how the gravitational wave like changed in pitch, for example. And so the idea here, back to primordial black holes, is that if our baby universe, when it first kind of like spawned, if it created enough black holes to account for dark matter, then these black holes would have settled into binary pairs, which is basically like when you have two black holes orbiting each other, and then they would merge. And then a third black hole would approach, and this would give us a three-body problem. So this is where things get kind of complex. I know we're introducing a lot of complex topics, but you would have two black holes that are orbiting each other, and you would have a third black hole approach, kind of like a three-body problem. And then as these two bodies are like orbiting each other, the third black hole would switch places with one of the black holes that's already orbiting. And so this would repeat over and over again, and then eventually the black holes would have a circular orbit. And so let me just repeat this. This whole cycle of these binary pairs of black holes that are orbiting each other and then being switched out with a third black hole over and over and over again. If the baby universe had created enough black holes to account for dark matter today, then this is what should have happened. And so let me just simplify this even more. The way I want to think about like these binary systems of black holes with the third black hole approaching and switching out, it's kind of like a line dance. So this is kind of where the Texan in me comes out. If you didn't know, I'm from Texas, and I vividly remember this. I hope if you're not from Texas or a southern area, you can relate. But if you think about a line dance, right? So imagine you're like linking arms with someone, and you're doing a line dance. So you're going around, and then you're going to switch to another partner. So it's kind of like linking arms with this partner, swinging around, and then moving on to the next partner, right? First, you and your partner, your original partner, you guys are like orbiting each other. And then eventually you let go of their arm and you move on to the next partner in the line. And then you guys start dancing around each other again. And that's kind of what it's like. You have two black holes that are orbiting each other and merging. And then you have a third black hole that approaches, switches out with one of the current black holes, and starts doing the thing all over again. So it's kind of like a line dance between black holes. The other important idea with primordial black holes, besides the fact that perhaps they could be accounting for dark matter, is that primordial black holes could have also played a role in the synthesis of heavy elements. So heavy elements such as gold, platinum, uranium, which has a lot of neutrons and protons. And so how this could have occurred is the primordial black holes could have collided with neutron stars, destroyed them, and then released neutron-rich material that would eventually create these heavy elements. And so first, neutron stars. What are these? Basically, they're the smallest and densest stars known to exist. And so a spoonful of the surface of a neutron star has about like the equivalent mass of like 3 billion tons. So what would happen is these primordial black holes, they would infest the center of the neutron stars, or they would become stuck in the center of neutron stars, and they would begin eating them from inside out. So remember, black holes are always hungry. They're always eating more matter, trying to get bigger and bigger. So what would happen is the primordial black holes, they'd be in the center of the neutron stars, eat them out from inside out, and they would pull material out, including neutrons. And then because the primordial black hole is kind of acting as like some sort of like pest or some sort of like parasite, the neutron star starts spinning super duper fast, and it flings material outwards into space. And this material that it's flinging outwards, we call it cold neutron matter, okay? And this cold neutron matter will decompress as it's flung outwards, and it'll heat up to create heavy elements. And then as this material or this cold neutron matter is like flung outwards, it's decompressing, it's heating up, it's in an environment where it can create these heavy metals. And that's how we could have gotten heavy elements like gold, platinum, and uranium. Okay, So that's a lot for primordial mass black holes. Basically, the thing to remember here is they could have created heavy elements, and perhaps they could be accounting for dark matter. That's like the big idea. They're also the smallest black holes. Next black hole, stellar mass black holes. And these are kind of what we know as the quote-unquote typical black holes. So we have exactly two theories for their formation. And the first one is what I was talking about in the last episode, like the typical idea that a massive star is running out of fuel, then it can't keep burning and radiating energy, which means there's no force to counteract the strong force of gravity, right? Because these stars have a lot of mass. And so as it's run out of fuel, the gravity is going to pull the star's mass inwards, and then it'll rebound it outwards in what we call a supernova blast. And so as the hydrogen on the outside of the star would rebound, that's how we get all these very pretty colorful images of like supernovas with big shells of gas on the outside. And what's collapsing down to the black hole is the core of the star, and that's because of the strong gravitational force. So this name of the stellar mass black holes, that should make sense, right? They're called stellar mass because these black holes have about the same mass as a star, and they're coming from a star. So that's our first theory of how stellar mass black holes can form. The other theory that we have is one that involves an explosion. So the idea is that an explosion could occur in a proto-neutron star, which is basically the first phase of life of a neutron star. So like, let's think about a baby neutron star, okay? So an explosion could occur in a baby neutron star, but even with this explosion, there's not enough energy for the star's material to be ejected outwards. So it's like a failure. The explosion is trying to eject the material outwards, but there's not enough energy to do that. So instead, the material is going to fall back into the star, and eventually, after a while, it takes a little bit longer, it'll create a black hole. And so again, stellar mass black holes are kind of like the seed for supermassive black holes. We think that maybe stellar mass black holes got bigger and bigger and bigger and could have eventually turned into a supermassive black hole. Now, stellar mass black holes are comprised or created from stars that are definitely larger than the sun, so at least 5 to 10 times larger. But what's interesting is that they are not comprised of black holes that are exactly 65 to 120 solar masses, or basically 65 to 120 times the mass of the sun. And that's because for stars in this size range, like this exact size range, they become so hot that they convert photons into pairs of particles and antiparticles. And an antiparticle is basically a particle but with opposite properties. So for example, if you have an electron and a positron is basically, it's like the same mass as an electron and it has the same properties except it's the opposite charge. So it has a positive charge. And so this is known as pair instability when photons are converted into pairs of particles and antiparticles. And so these photons of light or gamma rays, they have so much energy that they produce pairs of electrons and positrons. And so as they're producing pairs of electrons and positrons, the photons are disappearing. And because the photons, which is a form of radiation, they're disappearing, there's not enough radiation to support the star. And radiation pressure is essentially what supports the star's core. So if you don't have enough radiation, you don't have enough pressure from the radiation, and then the star is not supported. So then the star is going to collapse and explode, and it blasts off its outer layers. And so for stars in the specific range of 65 to 120 solar masses, or 65 to 120 times the mass of the sun, these explosions when the star collapses, these explosions destroy the star, but they're so strong that no black hole is left behind. And so if you have a star that's between 65 and 120 solar masses, it's not going to form a stellar mass black hole. And I know that's like a very specific number, but that's just how it is. So the other thing about stellar mass black holes is they're often found in binary star systems, which should make sense because we often find stars in binary star systems, which is basically where two stars are orbiting each other. And so we find stellar mass black holes in binary star systems. And the stellar mass black hole would pull the gas off a neighboring star. And so the way we detect stellar mass black holes is not directly. We kind of detect them as they pass in front of other stars. And that's because black holes, they have a ton of matter, right? So according to Einstein's theories, as black holes, or specifically as a stellar mass black hole passes in front of another star, it'll bend the light around it. And by bending the light, it'll briefly brighten and magnify the background star that it's passing in front of. And this phenomena is known as microlensing, okay? So as this star is microlensed, it'll brighten in a certain way. And if you see it brighten in this way, then you know that you've spotted a stellar mass black hole. And so that's how astronomers and astrophysicists and physicists, that's how they're spotting these stellar mass black holes. So the last cool thing about stellar mass black holes is that they go through accretion cycles. And this is basically a three-step cycle that I kind of want to think about like a hungry child. And I'll explain that. But basically, the first step is that the stellar mass black hole will emit a burst of light in response to an influx of material from a companion star. So a companion star is kind of giving it food that it's eating, okay? And it's becoming bigger and bigger. And because of this, it's emitting a burst of light, okay? Now, the second step. Now the black hole that it's emitted this burst of light, it's going to go through two phases, known as the soft phase and the hard phase. So first, the soft phase. This is a phase that's dominated by the accretion disk. And basically what it is stellar mass is being pulled into the black hole. So as the black hole's eating more and more material, it's in its soft phase, okay? Then once it's kind of out of material to eat, it goes through what it's called a hard phase. And that's basically where there's a white hot corona of high energy X-rays taking over, okay? So it goes through the soft phase where it's eating a bunch of food and eating a bunch of matter. Then when there's not enough matter left to eat, it stops and it goes through the hard phase where there's just a hard, white hot corona of high energy X-rays. And then after this hard phase, it goes through the last step, which is like known as a steady state. And that's basically kind of where it's doing nothing and just existing, okay? And then it'll be in that state for a while and it'll repeat all over again and then go back to like eating food and emitting a burst of light, then soft phase, then hard phase, then steady state. And so the analogy I want to give you here is kind of like a hungry child. You know, like children, when you're young, you don't really understand the value of like vegetables and healthy food. So the first thing you want to eat is usually like carbohydrates and sugar. Okay, so the soft phase of a black hole is kind of like a child who's eating a ton of carbs and sugar. So you're eating and you're eating and you're eating, right? And that's kind of similar to how a black hole is pulling more and more stellar material inside. Then it goes to the hard phase. And for a child, this would be like when after the child has eaten all the carbs and sugar, it's super duper hyper, right? Because obviously your blood sugar levels are spiking. So the child is super hyper. It's so full of energy. And that's kind of like the black hole. In the hard phase, the black hole just has this white hot corona of high energy X-rays. And it's just super duper duper energetic. And then it goes to the steady state. And so for the child, this is like after you've eaten your ton of carbs and sugar. Okay, so you're in the steady state where now you've eaten so much food that you're super full and you don't want to eat for a while. And for the black hole, this is basically where it's just existing. It's not eating any more matter or taking in any more matter. It's just there. And then eventually it'll repeat the cycle, right? Okay, next black hole is the intermediate black hole. And this is the black hole I was talking about that's not like confirmed by science. It's basically a theory. So this is kind of what scientists refer to as like the Goldilocks black hole. That's because it's not too big, but it's not too small. It's like just the right size of a black hole. But even though I'm saying that, it's kind of funny because this black hole is like the hardest to detect, even though it's supposedly, quote unquote, just the right size. So this black hole is about the size, like in between the stellar mass black hole and the supermassive black hole. And it's between 100 and 1,000 solar masses. The thing about this black hole is we've never found a black hole of that size before. And they're also super hard to find because they're less active, so they're not eating as much matter and getting as big. Otherwise, they would basically be a supermassive black hole. When intermediate mass black holes form, we don't really know how they form, but this is just a theory. There's no large supernova explosion before forming, so we can't really track that. And there's no glowing accretion disk around the intermediate black hole. And so if you remember, the accretion disk is kind of like that disk of hot gas around the black hole. And that for a lot of black holes, and for supermassive black holes especially, that makes them very visible. So it's easier to detect them and see them and kind of track them. But because intermediate black holes, they don't have a glowing accretion disk, we can't really track them. So again, their existence is kind of just like a theory. We don't really know if they exist. We're just kind of hoping they do, because that would solve a lot of our problems. So for intermediate mass black holes, really the only way to find them is to find them right in the middle of eating. And that's kind of hard because like I said, they're a little less active than supermassive black holes. So really the only way we can track them is if we find them right in the middle of when they're eating up a huge star. And the other problem with intermediate mass black holes is that the majority of them are outside the sensitivity range of like the current gravitational wave detectors we have. And like I said earlier, that's kind of how we detect black holes, right? We look at microlensing and we also look at gravitational wave movements that we receive. And so because most of these intermediate black holes are out of the sensitivity range of the technology that we would use to detect gravity waves or gravitational waves, we can't really detect them. So again, we're just kind of like, we hope they exist. Do we know they exist? Not really. Do we think they exist? Maybe. There's a lot of debate about it. So right now, the consensus, I guess, is that we're assuming that intermediate black holes do exist Because if you think about it, if a supermassive black hole never went through the phase of being an intermediate black hole, how would they get that big, right? Like, they would have to go, like, through that phase at some point. So at some point in their existence, even if they don't exist right now, a supermassive black hole should have been an intermediate mass black hole. And so the problem that a lot of astrophysicists are going through right now is that there is no known way to form intermediate mass black holes. And so their existence is kind of like unaccounted for in current theories of how black holes form. And so now we have three theories. I'm going to present to you the three popular theories for how intermediate mass black holes could have formed. So let's go. This is a series. So the first formation theory is that they could have formed when smaller stellar mass black holes merged. And so these would be basically interactions between stellar mass black holes in a young cluster, okay? Or stellar masses or stellar objects in a young cluster. And this would have to be a young cluster because stellar masses, as we talked about earlier, these black holes and these objects are large enough that you don't need a bunch of merging events for them to become the size of an intermediate mass black hole. So they would only need to merge like a couple times to become this size. So that's why the cluster could be young, because they don't have to merge a bunch to be the size of an intermediate black hole. Okay, the second theory we have is that these intermediate black holes could have formed as a result of interactions of compact objects in an older cluster. So the first theory was like it could have been stellar objects and stellar interactions in a young cluster. This theory is saying, okay, maybe we could have had interactions between compact objects and an older cluster. And the reason this must be an older cluster is because compact objects are much smaller than the intermediate mass black holes that they would eventually form. So this cluster would have to be pretty old because the objects that are compact, they'd have to merge many, many, many times in order to form something that would become the size of an intermediate mass black hole. And the other problem with these compact objects and this older cluster is that with these compact objects, direct collisions don't happen. And that's like the simplest way for merging events to occur. So if we don't have direct collisions, it's a little harder for these merging events to occur. And so for them to have happened and to have created something the size of an intermediate mass black hole, the cluster would have to be much older. So that way, as time passed, we could have these merging events occur naturally and these small objects eventually become that size. Okay, the third theory is that perhaps intermediate mass black holes could have been produced by population 3 stars. And so population 3 star is basically like the first type of star that formed. And perhaps these stars could have then produced stars that produce intermediate mass black holes. So there's not really favoritism towards any one of these theories. They all could be valid or they all could not be valid if intermediate black holes don't actually exist. So who knows? Again, this is like a lot of question. The other thing about intermediate mass black holes is that perhaps in smaller galaxies, we could have an intermediate mass black hole in the center. So I'm going to expand on this later a little bit more, but the idea here is that basically every galaxy has a black hole in its center, and the size of a galaxy is going to correspond to the size of the black hole in the center. So if we have a smaller galaxy, maybe we could have a smaller black hole in the center. And obviously small is like a relative term. It's not actually something super tiny. It's still going to be pretty large. And so this quote-unquote small black hole in the center, perhaps it could be an intermediate black hole in the center in the center of these like smaller galaxies, and then that would be like an intermediate mass black hole. And so astronomers now, they're kind of looking for these intermediate mass black holes in globular clusters, which are basically groups of hundreds of thousands of stars that formed in the same place from the same gas. And so by looking in these globular clusters, we're kind of looking here because we're thinking, okay, maybe if this globular cluster has a high escape velocity, which means that it's basically very hard to leave the cluster because you'd have to be going at an extremely fast speed. Perhaps it'd be really hard for a black hole to be like quote unquote kicked out. And so we would have these stellar mass black holes that form from the stars in the globular clusters, and then they would be forced to merge into an intermediate mass black hole because they can't leave the globular cluster since it has such a high escape velocity, right? So you have a globular cluster which has stars which would form stellar mass black holes. Then the cluster has such a high escape velocity that none of these black holes can leave. So they're basically forced to merge. And then by merging, they eventually would become an intermediate mass black hole. So now that I've confused you enough, we're going to talk about the next type of black holes. And these are the largest ones. And they're called supermassive black holes. And these black holes contain between 1 million and 1 billion times more mass than stellar black holes. So just Kind of think about that, because a stellar black hole, at its smallest, contains 5 to 10 times the mass of the sun. So now think about a supermassive black hole contains between a million and a billion times more mass than these stellar black holes. Right, that's like freaking ginormous. And so these black holes, thankfully, unlike intermediate mass black holes, they are confirmed because they radiate over 1 trillion times, yes, 1 trillion times, I'm going to say it again, 1 trillion times as much energy as the sun. Just like, wow, thinking about black holes just really makes me like, it puts my own problems into perspective because they really don't matter on the macroscopic scale of the universe. So anyways, these supermassive black holes, they radiate over 1 trillion times as much energy as the sun. And the only way to produce that much energy is to convert gravitational energy into light. And how do we do that? Using supermassive black holes. And so as I was kind of briefly touching upon earlier, we theorize that there's a supermassive black hole in the center of every galaxy. And so for example, in the center of our Milky Way, we have a supermassive black hole called Sagittarius A. Okay, and the sun is actually orbiting this supermassive black hole. So in a way, we are kind of orbiting it too, because if we orbit the sun and the sun is orbiting the supermassive black hole in the center of the Milky Way, then Earth is kind of orbiting Sagittarius A. And so the way we kind of discovered this black hole was through the stars that are around it. And that's because the stars that are closest to Sagittarius A and to supermassive black holes in the center of galaxies, these stars are orbiting black holes at like abnormally high rates. They're so fast. The ones that are closest to Sagittarius A, they're orbiting at 8% of the speed of light. They take 12 years to orbit this ginormous black hole. And that is really fast. The sun is taking 250 million years to orbit this black hole. So that is like a ginormous difference. And so astronomers, they were looking at this like, okay, we see these stars are moving extremely fast, but how? And the only like reason behind it that could be, you know, logical is that they're being accelerated by a supermassive black hole because it has such a strong gravitational field that it's able to kind of compel these stars to move super duper duper fast. So again, because the supermassive black holes, they have such strong gravitational field, the gas and the accretion disk that's kind of around the supermassive black hole, it's moving at such a high speed that it's heated to extraordinarily high temperatures. And it's so hot that they literally glow. So if you look up any picture of like a supermassive black hole, you'll see like glowing gas around it. It's really cool. And so scientifically, this is occurring because the crushing force of gravity from the black hole, it's compressing the matter that's coming in. And so formally, we refer to this as like the accretion flow. So it's compressing the matter that's coming in into smaller and smaller volumes, okay? And so that's kind of what's causing this gas to be heated to such high temperatures and then start glowing. So the way we track these black holes or these supermassive black holes is through water masers. And so basically, water masers are water molecules that are rotating in the black hole's accretion disk. Or if you want to be a little fancier, it's like maser emission from a water vapor near a black hole. And so maser emission is basically the radio wavelength equivalent of a laser. So water is colliding with other material, and then elements surrounding the hydrogen and oxygen atoms. Hi guys, it's editing Francesca here. I keep saying elements in this clip. I meant electrons, not elements. I meant electrons. Okay. So water is colliding with other material, and then elements surrounding the hydrogen and oxygen atoms that are making up the water, these elements get so excited to high energy levels. So as it's getting excited, then it returns to the ground state. And as it's returning to the ground state, in doing that, it's emitting laser-like microwave radiation, or what we call maser. And so that's basically water maser. And what's cool about water masers is that they trace the kinematics of these disks. And so by doing so, they kind of enable scientists to estimate the mass of these supermassive black holes. And that's how we can kind of like keep track of supermassive black holes using these water masers. So what we haven't talked about yet with supermassive black holes is like, how do they form? And so we kind of have like a few theories. This is kind of like the astrophysicist chicken and the egg. So here's one theory. Perhaps a supermassive black hole was originally a stellar mass black hole that pulled material off other stars in the galaxy. And so it kept eating and feeding and growing bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until it turned into a supermassive black hole. And then this theory would also support intermediate mass black holes because at some point, as a stellar mass black hole was growing, it would have had to be the size of an intermediate mass black hole. So what would happen, and kind of what's supporting this idea, is that Remember the accretion cycle we were talking about earlier with stellar mass black holes, where it was going through the soft phase of kind of pulling in material, and then it was going through the hard phase where it just was sitting there with like a corona of high energy X-rays, and then it was going through steady state where it would just exist, and then it would repeat the cycle, right? So that was the accretion cycle. Well, this accretion cycle can actually occur in supermassive black holes, and it only occurs during major events. So for example, if the black hole is tidally disrupting a star. The reason it doesn't normally occur in supermassive black holes is because these black holes are so large that this accretion cycle would take thousands of years. And obviously we don't live for thousands of years, so we can't measure it. But when we have these major events, such as the black hole tidally disrupting a star, these accretion cycles, they're sped up. And so as we get an influx of material, or as the black hole suddenly gets like to dine on a lot of food, it gets to eat a lot of matter up, these cycles speed up. And then as the cycles speed up, that is kind of when we can actually observe and track the accretion cycles in supermassive black holes. So that's kind of one theory, is like, perhaps a supermassive black hole could have formed from a stellar mass black hole that just kept eating more and more and more matter and growing bigger and bigger. Now the other theory is that maybe these supermassive black holes formed first in the early universe. And what happened was that in the early universe, in our baby universe, we had a giant gas cloud, but most giant gas clouds turned into stars. So the difference here is that this giant gas cloud would not turn into a star like it usually would, and it just became a black hole straight away. So it was just like the first thing to form. Like in the early universe, you have a giant gas cloud, but instead of turning into a star, it just became a black hole. We don't know. Both of these theories could be correct. So really, we don't know. So the other cool thing about supermassive black holes is that they give off galactic jets. And that is like a fancy, super duper cool space term. It's like the type of thing you'd see in like Star Wars or something. And so what these jets are, is they're thin beams of plasma that extend millions of light years in length. Like just think about that. Millions of light years in length. And they trigger the formation of like successive star generations. And so these jets that came from the first black holes, they also gave the first generations of starlight. And so with these galactic jets, we think these thin beams of plasma that extend millions of light years, we think they form by the interactions between a supermassive black hole's magnetic field and an accretion disk. And so here's the kind of like the process that we currently think is occurring. So we think hot gas around the supermassive black hole is creating a plasma, and this plasma should be able to carry magnetic fields. Then we think that these rotating supermassive black holes, they're twisting magnetic fields into tight helix, kind of like the shape of DNA. And as it's twisting these magnetic fields into tight helix, it's generating a voltage, okay? And this voltage generation is able to draw the energy up and out of the supermassive black hole's hole and along this helix. And so the magnetic field is also in the shape of a spiral. And because of this process of drawing energy up and out of the hole and along the helix, and because the magnetic field is shaped as a spiral, we are able to launch jets of plasma. Just doesn't that sound like something from Star Wars? It just sounds so cool. It sounds almost like fake, but it's real. And so eventually, these jets that were launching up into space, these thin beams of plasma, they change structure from parabolic to conical. And that's kind of how they're released. And these jets are also able to enhance the growth rate of black holes. And so that's kind of why they're released. If you think about it logically, like as the supermassive black holes, they're releasing these galactic jets and increasing their growth rate. So they can grow faster and faster and bigger and eat more and more food. Okay, that's a lot. The last type of black hole, it's kind of the same as a supermassive black hole, but not really. And these are quasars. So quasars are the same size as a supermassive black hole. Don't worry about it. Supermassive black holes cannot get any bigger. So they're the same size. And a quasar is essentially a supermassive black hole that gets brighter and brighter as it eats more stuff. And it's so bright that it's giving off like X-rays, it's giving off UV rays, it's giving off radio waves. It's literally the brightest object in the galaxy. And because they're so bright, they overshadow and outshine every other star in the galaxy. So if we look at a galaxy that's neighboring us or a distant galaxy, these quasars are so bright that they outshine every other star in the galaxy. So it seems as if the quasar is like the only star there. And so when we look in the sky and we see a quasar, they kind of appear like stars because they look like a star from just another galaxy or a star in our galaxy maybe because they're that bright, but they're not. They're not a star. It's a black hole that is so bright that it appears like a star. The name quasars they come from quasi-stellar. So we thought of them as quasi-stellar, and then if you remove, like, the psi and the stell, you get quasars. And basically, quasi-stellar means almost star-like, which should make sense because quasars are almost star-like because they're so bright. And so how quasars become so bright is because the gas around it, so gas in, like, the accretion disk, it approaches the speed of light. It's moving that fast. And for the gas to move that fast, you know it must be super-duper hot. So it's heating up, it's super fast, and it's super-duper-duper bright as it's heating up. And that's how we can see it from so far away. In fact, a lot of quasars are, like, super far away, but we see them as if they're closer than some stars that are actually closer than the quasar. And so quasars tend to form in regions where the density is much greater than the average density. And quasars also have a really cool kind of phenomena. So with supermassive black holes, we had galactic jets, right? And with quasars, we have active galactic nuclei. And so quasars are essentially equivalent to this active galactic nuclei. An active galactic nuclei has tons of radiation. And this radiation is theorized to form from the accretion of matter from supermassive black holes. And that's because there's such intense friction generated by the dust and gas particles that are zooming around the black hole. So this intense friction generated by these gas particles in the accretion disk emits radiation. And this radiation gives the quasar a very, very, very high luminosity. Or in this case, it's also giving active galactic nuclei very high luminosity. And so active galactic nuclei, these are the most luminous and persistent sources of radiation. And because they're so bright, this is how we can kind of discover distant objects. With active galactic nuclei, there's more than one type. So another type that we categorize is known as the Seyfert galaxy. And these are not the same as quasars because they're younger and well-defined. And so the difference between this galaxy and quasars is that these galaxies, the center of the galaxy is, of course, very bright, but you can also see the rest of the galaxy. Whereas with quasars, you can only see this black hole in the center of the galaxy because it's so bright that it outshines everything else. The last thing I wanted to say about quasars is that all galaxies have gone through a quasar phase. So all galaxies have a supermassive black hole in the middle, right? And they've all gone through this quasar phase where the center supermassive black hole was super duper 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 bright. The only thing is that maybe now they're not all going through the quasar phase. So some galaxies have kind of like chilled out. For example, the Milky Way, we're not going through our quasar phase right now. So Sagittarius A has just kind of calmed down because the black hole has been starved of material for a while. It doesn't have anything to eat that would light it up. And so some galaxies are currently going through their quasar phase where they're super duper bright and other galaxies are just kind of chilling out. But at some point in time, all galaxies have gone through a quasar phase where the center supermassive black hole was just eating like crazy and growing like crazy and it was super duper bright. Okay, my voice is honestly really tired right now. We went through a lot this episode, and I hope you can tell that this episode definitely took me a while to like research and put together, and I was reading like a lot of academic papers and articles, but it was so enriching and so rewarding, and this is just genuinely one of my favorite things to talk about. And so before we ended this episode, because we covered so much material, I just wanted to do like a quick review of everything that we learned today, because there was a lot. So we have five types of black holes, right? We have primordial black holes, stellar mass black holes, intermediate mass black holes, supermassive black holes, and quasars. And these are all in increasing order of size, except that quasars are essentially supermassive black holes that are just very, very bright. So let's go through all of them one by one. First, primordial mass black holes. These could be the source of dark matter in the universe, but that's kind of contentious among physicists. Also, these black holes were formed right after the Big Bang due to density fluctuations because you would have some regions that were more dense than others. And primordial black holes are also the smallest black holes, and they could have synthesized heavy elements such as gold, platinum, and uranium. Okay. Next, stellar mass black holes. So these are like the typical black holes that you think of, right? They're formed after a star dies, hence the name stellar mass black holes, since they have like the same mass of a star. And what's special about stellar mass black holes is the accretion cycles that they go through. So remember we were talking about like the hungry child analogy? So they go through a soft phase where these stellar mass black holes are pulling in material from the accretion disk and they're eating and they're eating and they're eating. Then they get super hyper. So their blood sugar levels are kind of spiking and they go through a hard phase where all these stellar mass black holes have is like a high energy white corona. And then this energy kind of fades away and then they go through a steady state where these black holes, they're not eating anymore. They're just kind of existing. And that's kind of like how the hungry child, after eating all this food and after being super hyper, it's so full. This child is so full that it doesn't want to eat food for a while. So then this accretion cycle just repeats over and over and over again. Okay, next black hole, intermediate mass black holes are kind of like the Goldilocks black hole. And this is the only black hole that's like just a theory. We don't know if it actually exists, and it's very, very controversial. Like I said earlier, these black holes are very hard to detect, and we have many theories for its formation, but we have no answers. We don't know which one of these could have been true. And so for these black holes, we kind of look to see them in globular clusters, especially if the globular cluster has a very high escape velocity, because then stars would kind of be forced to merge into these intermediate mass black holes. Okay, last two. So the second to last one, supermassive black holes. These are super duper duper big, and they're at the center of every galaxy. And our supermassive black hole in the center of the Milky Way is called Sagittarius A. And so in these black holes, the gas is so bright around them because it's moving so fast and at such a high temperature. We detect supermassive black holes through water masers, which is, if you remember, it's basically how water particles are kind of interacting around the black hole's accretion disk. These supermassive black holes are also emitting galactic jets, which is when the magnetic field of the supermassive black hole is interacting with the accretion disk, and then that kind of creates jets of like plasma, which travels for millions of light years. And the last black hole is quasars. These are personally my favorite to kind of learn about and explore because they're just so cool. And these are supermassive black holes that are so, so bright that they appear as if they're the only object in the galaxy. And so these black holes are brighter than some stars that are much closer nearby, but they're so bright that they appear brighter than these stars. And these quasars are basically equated to active galactic nuclei. And basically what that means is that they emit tons of radiation formed from the accretion of matter. All right, that is a lot. So to end this episode off, I hope it taught you some new facts about black holes, and I definitely learned a lot doing research for this episode, and I hope now that you've learned some more about black holes, you're kind of intrigued, go do some research of your own, go learn some more. There's a lot of academic papers online that are like genuinely so fascinating. So thank you for tuning in, and don't forget to share this podcast with your friends so they can also learn more about space, because space is cool. And this episode was definitely a fun one. And just to give you a hint into next week's episode, I think we're going to be talking about dark matter and what is known as WIMPs. And that's kind of an acronym. And no, I am not talking about a WIMP who's like a super weak person. We're talking about a totally different type of WIMP that's related to space. It's a cool thing. Okay. Anyways, I'm super excited to see you then. Don't forget to tune in, and I hope you have a nice day. Bye-bye.